Pseudopod 86, April 18th, 2008. This week's story, The Wild Why by Tej Grant. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm your host, Alistair Stewart, and this week's story comes to us from Tej Grant. Originally published in Bruterian in autumn 2001, their work has also appeared on Well Told Tales and in Twisted Shift, amongst others. So shave, shower, and get ready to serve your country, because I've got a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
The Wild Why by Tej Grant. Paul Toland liked it best as high up as he could squirrel himself beneath the bridge, right up there at the nexus, where the superstructure of the bridge itself sliced in to connect with the finished concrete of the street. Here, with his bag of belongings, his bottle, and his razor, he felt safe and content. A small voice from his earlier life told him that this was only a primitive retreat to the womb fantasies that everyone had somewhere in their subconscious. He told the small voice to shut the hell up. Paul was younger than most of the residents under the bridge, and in somewhat better condition, though certainly no poster boy for Health and Fitness magazine. In fact, he was sort of like their king, as long as those damned, spike-haired, body-pierced punkers stayed on their own turf, anyway. Tonight was a sweet one. Late May, nighttime temperature hovering around 70, almost too warm, but with a frisky and teasing wind to alleviate any discomfort, bringing with it the salty taste of the bay. It was moonless and quiet, too. By 4 a.m., Paul was in a deep sleep that was unbroken by even the dreams that tended to haunt his nights. The lights came out of nowhere, like three physical lances. Two were the headlights of the car, while the third was a fender-mounted spotlight as bright as the others combined. Though their abrupt appearance was silent, the energy playing on Paul's closed eyelids was enough to penetrate the heavy blanket of sleep and drag him back into awareness. And this, naturally, incited a severe round of coughing. "Paul Richard Toland?" asked a stern voice from the darkness behind the lights, though it was hardly a question.
"What?" Paul mumbled, hacking up something thick from his lungs. "Get those goddamn lights out of my eyes. Who are you?"
They were cops of some kind, of course. Nobody else acted with such regal contempt. "We're going to ask you to accompany us, Mr. Toland," the voice went on. "Please rise and come to the car."
"Please go to hell," Paul responded while attempting to shield his eyes from the glare.
There was a defiance in the words that he didn't really feel. He was in trouble, that was clear enough, even if he didn't have a clue as to why, and he could expect precious little help from his fellow bridge residents, all of whom were busy getting their own tails well away from the evolving situation.
"I asked you who you were."
Two dark figures emerged from the light and moved toward him. These folks weren't playing games. One of them flipped open a wallet badge as he squatted to approach Paul's squeezed-down retreat. "Federal agents, Mr. Toland," he said. "You can come with us voluntarily, or we can drag your filthy ass into the car. It's your choice, but we will be away from here within the minute."
"Damn," Paul sighed.
He tried to bring along his bag of possessions, knowing full well that none of them would be here when, if, he ever returned, but the men would have none of that. They practically tossed him into the rear of a long sedan and slammed the door. Then he received a pleasant surprise for a change.
"Good evening, Mr. Toland," said the gorgeous blonde woman, who already sat in the rear seat. From the long, slim brown legs that were barely hidden by her short skirt, to the blue eyes that seemed to radiate in the dimness of the night, it was clear that this lady meant business. "This appears to be your lucky night."
"We'll see," Paul grunted. The woman was causing all too infrequent stirrings within him, but he still didn't appreciate being bum-rushed this way, and no cop, local or fed, had ever done anything good for him. He felt a familiar sinking sensation in his stomach as the car glided silently from beneath the bridge. Once they were out of the city limits and into the surrounding countryside, the woman offered him a cigarette, which he refused, and then a drink from a very handy little bar. He accepted this.
"To your satisfaction, Mr. Toland?" she asked casually after he had drained the glass, though the two of them were separated by a smoked glass partition from the steroid heads who had bounced him into the car, she didn't seem at all uncomfortable alone with him.
"That's good liquor," he answered. He extended the glass toward her. "I'll have another."
"Of course," she deftly poured him a second drink. "But we have some important and rather complicated matters to discuss."
"Heh,"
Lady, you don't have enough booze in this car to get me buzzed.
Good. Now, you are Paul Richard Toland of Minneapolis, Minnesota, known during your acting days as Paul Talbot, correct?
Who wants to know?
Her perfectly made-up brows frowned slightly. Mr. Toland, we really don't have much time, and this will go much more smoothly.
It's a trade-off, girl. I give you some, and then I get some back from you. I may look like a besotted piece of human garbage to you, but I'm not an idiot.
She nodded. We know you're much more than what you appear to be, Mr. Toland. All right. I am Agent Julianne Nielsen of the Secret Service.
That was enough of a shock to stop Paul in mid-swallow.
The Secret Service? You mean the people who... Yes, we're the people who protect the President and his family, and you are Paul Toland, a.k.a. Paul Talbot, who studied acting at the New York Academy of Fine Arts, talented mimic, and former co-star of the ABC television comedy series Everybody Wants to Rule the World. He was impressed.
You've done your homework. Who do I owe money?
It's not that, Mr. Toland. You're not even under arrest. In fact, we're about to make you the offer of a lifetime, one which will bring you back into acting and provide you with a role more powerful than any you've dreamed of before. We want you to join the service. Completely stunned by this statement, Paul nevertheless was unable to follow it up with any questions when the car arrived at its destination, a cunningly concealed government installation in the rolling Maryland hillside. He tried to resume the conversation, but the two studs in the front of the vehicle hustled him out, and then into a place that seemed to be some sort of private spa, where he was virtually ordered to shower. Following this procedure, which did feel pretty nice, he had to admit, he was dressed in new underwear and a luxurious robe before being subjected to a shave and haircut that left his reflection in the mirror almost unrecognizable. It had been years, decades actually, since he had resembled that Paul Talbot. Feeling better? Julianne Nielsen asked brightly once they were reunited in a small, private room somewhere in the depths of the installation.
I'm feeling nervous, he told her. He might have said this for effect, but there was a lot of truth to it, too. I know that everything comes with a price, and the government, especially, would never go to this much trouble simply because they believed a 57-year-old homeless drunk named Paul Toland would make a good Secret Service agent. I think it's time to show our cards. Tell me what all this is about, or I start hollering for a lawyer. If that makes any difference to you people.
It does, she assured him. Despite your fears, Paul, this isn't a kidnapping or some nefarious government plot to wipe out the homeless with kindness. Julianne stood and began to walk about the tiny room, giving him every opportunity to admire her lithe young body. You're one in approximately 30 million men, Paul. You were born with a unique condition, which was discovered only 18 months ago by the finest medical minds in the world, and which has been kept strictly secret since then. It's called the Wild Y syndrome, and appears to be a natural progression in human evolution. Paul felt the curtain drawing to a close over this nice, if brief, interlude in his life.
I'm no science fiction mutant, Julianne. I don't read minds, move objects by sheer thought power, or tear military tanks apart with my hands. I'm just a washed-up comic actor who could have made a decent living in dinner theater once his sidekick days were over, but who liked the grape so much that he decided to retire into a bottle. I know your advanced fiction writing division labored long and hard over this little scenario, something about how my magic blood will keep aging billionaires alive and healthy in perpetuity, but I saw that story when Christopher George played it in his TV series. So please, spare me the...
The woman placed one cool, scented finger over his lips. Will you just shut up for a moment? She smiled as she said this. Maybe she did actually have something real and important to tell him. The Wild Y syndrome is completely latent in the men who carry it. It affects only their Y chromosome, the one which makes them male. You know, XX, girl, XY, boy.
I'm not an idiot.
Sorry. Anyway, in these rare cases, estimated to occur in only one of 30 million live male births at this time, the Y chromosome is in a variable state. You'd never notice in your regular life, but your Y is susceptible to virtually any other DNA pattern which might be introduced into it properly. This makes you a human chameleon, in effect. If another pattern is imprinted on you, your body will immediately respond to it and replicate the physical makeup of the new pattern down to the last cell. In other words, if we obtained a sample of, say, Johnny Depp's DNA,
and injected you with it in the facilitating medium in just about 15 minutes, Johnny Depp's identical twin would be sitting here before me. She smiled, just a touch lasciviously. You're crazy, Paul whispered. This isn't even bad science fiction. It's below that level. The words intrigued him, even as they scared the hell out of him, so he decided to take the antagonistic role. Julianne continued as if she hadn't heard. Of course, your mind would be unaffected, insulating your personality, memory, and essence from the radical metamorphosis that your body was undergoing, and we would be certain to secure a sample of your original DNA before the procedure in order to return you to yourself when you were finished being Johnny Depp, though I can't say I understand why any man would want to stop being Mr. Depp. Paul could no longer find any words with which to interrupt the young woman. So you see how effective a man of your genetic abilities and accomplished acting background can be as an operative for the government. You can become anyone we need you to be, sign binding agreements as a foreign leader, foment rebellion as a cultural icon, infiltrate the most tightly sealed off, dangerous societies in the perfect disguise. A person's DNA can be extracted from almost anything, including hair, a flake of skin, a fingernail cutting, but to maintain optimum effectiveness, we have to keep this perfectly secret. No one other than the most rarefied of government insiders has as much as a hint of this discovery, and even our recruiting has to be done confidentially, through the records of people treated at hospitals and by private physicians throughout the nation. Then how did you find me? Paul managed to whisper. I haven't seen a doctor in 15 years. How do you afford your liquor, Paul? She asked with an odd combination of bluntness and concern. You sell your blood, don't you? The trait is readily detectable in the blood, and every licensed blood agency now reports any positive results directly to us. We've known about you for months now, watched you. The trait is extremely rare, as I said, about 1 in 30 million men and boys, and you are the one in this area. But your acting talent and gift for mimicry played as much a part in your selection tonight as your proximity to us. There has been an accident in the White House, and we'll need you prepped and ready first thing in the morning. The air left his lungs as if he had sustained a physical blow. Jesus Christ, the president was dead somehow, and they wanted him to be the president, at least until an orderly transferring of the office to the vice president could be made. She hadn't been lying about offering him the role of his life. A sense of excitement that Paul Toland hadn't felt in years stirred tentatively within his chest. Impressions had always been his forte, as well as his greatest joy, and with the president's own body as his makeup and clothing, what a performance he would be able. The excitement began to seep away as gently as it had come to him. He was a 57-year-old, hopeless alcoholic. Even a one-day performance was forever beyond him now. He gave Julianne a rather sad smile. Honey, you should have caught my action 20 years ago. She nodded, as if reading his mind. We thought you might feel that way, so we've prepared this demonstration. Paul didn't realize that everything occurring in that small room was under close scrutiny by other members of the service until that very moment, when 4 guys the size of football linemen marched through the single doorway and pinned him back in the reclining chair in which he sat, while one of them swabbed his bare right forearm with an alcohol pad and produced a syringe loaded with some reddish solution. He struggled, of course. His years on the street forced him to make this effort. But he was a child in their hands, and Julianne was suddenly at his side, whispering comfortingly into his ear. Shh, stay calm, calm. This is only a demonstration, as I told you, and we're using your own genetic pattern, she told him. According to the prior test subjects, you're about to experience pleasure beyond anything you've ever known. Please settle down. Then revelation came to Paul Toland, exploding at the point of entry into his arm and spreading swiftly outward in all directions from there. Every cell that the energy touched lit up with a blazing sensation that carried only pure, passionate delight. The feeling swept through his arm and into his body and head, so that he was engulfed by it, shivering on the chair in undiluted joy. It was better than anything he had ever felt. Better than booze, better than performing, better than sex, better than anything. He had no way of knowing how long he was gripped by the energy, but it was the most beautiful span of time he had ever lived. Finally, he lay quietly, still suffused with the warmth of the experience, but no longer controlled by it. His eyes were closed, and he couldn't find the strength to open them, but this sort of benevolent paralysis didn't terrify him as it should have. He understood that his body was simply adjusting to the event and would give him back movement and sight within seconds. He may have appeared to be asleep, but he could clearly hear everything going on about him. "God, I'll never get used to seeing that," said one of the four men who had held him. "It's like watching movie magic or something. What a high he must be feeling." "There's nothing else like it in nature," Julianne Nielsen's voice agreed. "Not even the metamorphosis of the butterfly. Would you fellows get the mirror in here for me?" There followed the sounds of a large object being wheeled into the room. With the abruptness of a thrown switch, complete mobility was restored to Paul. He sat up and snapped open his eyes. "What did you do to me?" he demanded. Despite the confusion swirling through him, he felt wonderful. He couldn't recall ever having felt so good. "Quite a charge, isn't it?" Julianne said. "Take a look." Paul looked into the full-length mirror which had been wheeled into the room, almost expecting to see the president's face staring back at him. Instead, he found himself a slimmer, clearer, more sharply defined version of himself. He was Paul Talbot again. "We've given you back 25 years of your life," Julianne continued. "The tremors and liver damage, all of the effects of your alcoholism, are a part of the past now. It's a constant side effect of the treatment. The DNA refines the body, removing age, disease, any sort of infirmity. The metamorphosis recreates the subject in a very nearly perfect condition, so that the man lucky enough to have this trait theoretically could live forever by simply undergoing the process every time the age begins to catch up to him." Paul couldn't pry his eyes from the image in the mirror, the solid black hair which had grown in to replace the gray that drifted about his shoulders now, the flawless skin, the clear eyes and keenly defined musculature. He had never been in this good a shape in his life. "So," she asked, "does your John Hancock go on the contract?" He said, "I would be like an agent for the government, going on missions vital to the future of the world, like James Bond or something." "Sweetie, I promise you, James Bond has never dreamed of what you'll be able to do. But we have to have your answer now. What happened with the president cannot be made public. This country needs that man too much." It was too much, too fast. Paul continued to gaze into the mirror. It was frightening in its potential. "I don't know." She kissed him. Then her hands were deftly loosening the belt of his robe as he found the zipper to her dress. They made love in the big chair, with a passion that replaced every memory of lovemaking in his soul. His powerful young body surprised him. Hers delighted him. He knew that they were watching him from elsewhere in the building, but he didn't care. He and Julianne lay cuddled together in the chair, and her lips found his ear again. "Are you with us, Paul?" "Show me the contract," he answered with a contented sigh. The word transformation might just as well have applied to the young woman at that instant. Without bothering to pull on even the robe, she slipped out of the chair and produced the legal document from a compartment beneath it. Paul scribbled his signature in the proper spots and then provided a full set of fingerprints on a separate sheet. She might just as well have been doing a tax audit. "Okay, people, let's get this show on the road," she said, and an entire team of operatives swarmed into the room to escort Paul to the next location. "Shouldn't I be, like, briefed or something?" he asked nervously as he struggled to wrap the robe about himself again. He retained some measure of modesty, even if his state of undress had no effect on them whatsoever. "I need background information, videotapes, and audio to get the nuances and the inflection right." "Don't worry about it," Julianne assured him. She had slipped back into her clothing before leaving the room. "You can pick up all the subtle touches over time. You have to appear in public early this morning, but you won't be called on to do more than smile and wave." Paul muttered, "How to become the President of the United States in one easy lesson." The next room was larger than the last, with much more space, all of it filled by interested members of the Secret Service. Their flat yet piercing expressions didn't change when the men attending Paul placed him on another padded recliner and took away the robe. His protests were ignored. Julianne leaned over him and placed a peck on his left cheek. "One last kiss for luck," she said. "Ready?" I suppose. Another medical person slipped the point of a needle into his right arm. He winced at the small pain before smiling to himself with the knowledge of what was coming next. "You know, I envy you," Julianne whispered. "They tell me the pleasure is indescribable, but women have two X's and no Y's, thus no wild Y's. You'll always have these two times to remember." The second seizure was every bit as overwhelming and fulfilling as the first, even while it was somehow different. Once the shivering had subsided, he lay in the comfort of the chair and radiated with the memory of it.
He definitely felt different this time, but that was only to be expected. After all, he was another man entirely now. Paul Toland, president. And that was only the beginning. After every mission, he would return to the perfection and potency of his own 25-year-old body, maybe even forever. How had he ever managed to fall into this bonanza? As before, those in the room resumed talking as if he were totally oblivious to their presence, even though he was only resting within the brief paralysis.
"God, I hope we don't have to do this with another one," said a man from somewhere to Paul's left. "We've located so few, and to use them up this way."
Then Julianne's voice was replying, "If someone had paid more attention to that stoned-out bastard earlier tonight, we wouldn't have to be doing it with this one. You people know what he's like when he's been doing coke."
"Placing blame doesn't help the situation, Agent Nielsen. We can't be around him all the time, you know, and he's a man of many passions."
"He's a man we have to get re-elected or retool for another damn Republican regime," she stated harshly, not at all like the seductive recruitment agent of moments earlier. "There won't be many voters eager to re-elect a drug-crazed strangler, will there?"
"We'll keep him on a tight leash this time," the man said. "He's always fine when he has an audience to play to."
A sharp crackle of panic raced through Paul's still form. What were they talking about? The president had murdered someone, and now they were going to cover it up? And the president was still going to be the president? Who? Julianne sighed. "You're right. Blame does no good at this point. After all, even the Secret Service can't be expected to be literally in bed with the first couple."
Movement returned to Paul Toland, and the former possessor of a wild Y chromosome opened his eyes, looked at his new body, and began to scream in a higher-pitched, unfamiliar voice.
John Updike once said, "From infancy on, we are all spies. The shame is not this, but that the secrets to be discovered are so paltry and few." And you know what? I really don't think I agree with him. Despite, it should be pointed out, my long-term surveilling of both the cupboard where the chocolate biscuits were kept and the big spooky wooden cow that wanted to eat my face that hung on the wall of my play school. Seriously, that cow was evil. It had plans. However, his central point is a good one. We are different people depending on who we talk to and who we spend time with. Back when I worked in the retail salt mines, one of the things that got me through the hard days was, oddly, a conscious decision to adopt a slightly different personality. In this case, the personality of Joe, the store manager from Empire Records. Incidentally, if you've not seen Empire Records, do so. Great movie, very much the unsung king of the mid-90s teen flick. So to get by, I got a little harder, a lot more cynical, pathologically fond of AC/DC, and it should be pointed out, if you're not singing along by the chorus of If You Want Blood, then seek immediate medical attention from the Doctor of Rock, and a lot more pathologically loyal to my staff. Because that way, if I was obsessing over the health and well-being of my team, then I didn't have to think about my own, which is either altruistic or biblically, apocalyptically, galactically stupid, depending on your point of view. I never said I was smart, I just said I was pretty. The thing is though, and this is where I really disagree with Updike, we have, I think, to work this way. People naturally mimic or mirror each other when they spend time together, and this process greases the wheels, keeps things polite, keeps society from being nothing more than a group of people loudly declaiming with complete and total frankness everything they believe without once taking into account the feelings of others. Or, to put it another way, and to quote the beloved webcomic XKCD, "I can't come to bed yet. Someone is wrong on the internet." Pseudopod relies on you for two things, and you know what? They're both vital. The first is a very simple and frequently overlooked fact. Our writers are also our listeners. It doesn't matter if you've got a bunch of pro credits or if this is your first time out of the gate. If we like the story, if it grabs us, then we'll go for it. It's really that simple. So, if you want to give it a try, go to pseudopod.org and check out our guidelines. Then, of course, there's Gordon Gekko's favourite thing. We rely on your donations to pay our authors, which could include you, don't forget. So, if you like this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. We promise you each red, or white, or blue, or puce cent is greatly appreciated. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod wants you to know there's a good chance you could die right here on this table.